When I faced him, his blue eyes were steady on mine, waiting for me to elaborate. I know that I feel more at home here than in New York. I was born and raised there, but if my story is about belonging, I feel like maybe I belong here, in Argentina. Isn't that funny?
Your parents are from here, right?
I nodded.
Your heritage is in you. You can't change who you are just by being born somewhere else.
I guess that's true. After we ordered a mozzarella pizza with red sauce and faina, a fried chickpea dough, I looked at him.
Why did you ask Soledad when Valentina's baby was born?
The words came out strongly, and I realized how much the question had been nagging at me. He noticed my tone and answered cautiously.
I don't know if you're aware of this, but babies born in captivity were often handed over to families in the military or the police force, or people who couldn't have their own children.
I see.
There were more than just a few cases, he continued. In fact, there were hundreds.
The next moments passed in silence. We sipped our wine. My father did date Valentina, I admitted. But he told me their relationship happened before my parents met.
Franco nodded, but I could sense he was skeptical.
To preempt any queries on his part, I continued.
Besides, Valentina's baby was born in September.
My birthday is in December. Looking at me over his glasses, Franco measured his words.
Babies were given false birth certificates. Birth dates were made up all the time.
Why are you telling me all this?
Given what was going on at the time, anything is possible.
Except for the tears that began to well, my face was expressionless. Franco extracted a pressed handkerchief from his back pocket.
May I?
He reached across the table and gently wiped away my tears.
If you want to learn more, I know someone we can talk to.
Chapter 26, September 1975.
On a Friday in early September, Maximo stood for hours under a driving rain outside Luna Park, Argentina's largest indoor stadium, mainly known for its boxing matches. He was in line to buy concert tickets for Argentina's most popular folk rock band, Sui Generis, as an early birthday surprise for Valentina. But on the day of the concert, he also surprised her by telling her he would not be able to go. The law school had changed the date for one of his assessments to the following day, and he would need every possible hour to study.
I'll stay in then. Make us dinner. I have papers to correct, Valentina said, going to the kitchen to see what meal she could rustle up.
Valentina's parents didn't know she had unofficially moved into Maximo's one-bedroom apartment in the neighborhood of Congreso. They thought she was still living in the studio they rented for her, in Almagro. They had driven in from Córdoba a month earlier to co-sign the lease. It was their graduation present to her. Valentina turned the studio into her workspace instead. As she took out a can of tomatoes to make a sauce for pasta, she told Maximo she could quiz him. Make him a gourd of mate, whatever she could do to help him pass the exam. She didn't tell him that she saw this as a rare opportunity for them to be together. He was often out late and came back when she was already asleep.
Go. Don't let me spoil your birthday present. Take grace, he insisted,
looking up only for a moment from the textbooks and handouts sprawled across the sofa and low coffee table they had purchased at a flea market in La Boca. Valentina gave in. She loved Sui Generis, and the concert was billed as the group's last. She invited Grace, and by the time they arrived at the indoor stadium, the band was already on stage. The lead singer was welcoming the audience, mostly students and young people, who had come in from the cool winter night dressed in wide-collared shirts, flared pants, V-neck sweaters, jean jackets. By the final song, the fans were out of their seats, singing and dancing. The police were outside, powerless to stamp out their joy. In retrospect, the concert would be seen as the beginning of a resistance movement through the arts, in particular, music in the form of rock nacional, that would sustain those who survived the government's brutal rule over the next few years. The women hugged and walked out of the stadium, arm in arm. The man whose shoulders Grace had climbed up on during the encore ran up and asked if they wanted to join him and some friends at a bar. Grace looked at Valentina and said, "Why not? The night is young."
"You go ahead. I need to get back home to Maximo."
Most buses weren't running due to a public transportation slowdown, but every now and again one would appear, bursting at the seams with passengers. Valentina waited with the other hopefuls, but when the next bus pulled up, she was still unable to get on.
"Valentina!"
She turned. It was Santiago. Her heart leaped in surprise. He was waving to her from inside a car, a Peugeot 504. She didn't recognize it, but then again, it had been at least a year and a half since she had been in a car with him. He opened the passenger door.
"Get in!"
He was smiling, as happy to see her as she was to see him. Without hesitating, she slid into the passenger seat.
"Were you at the concert?"
he asked as they left behind the dozens jostling to get a better spot in the bus line.
"Yes, with Grace."
"You just missed her."
"Did you go, too?" she asked, still feeling a euphoric high from the concert. And now, having run into Santiago, the night had taken on a magical quality.
"Yeah, with some friends."
Santiago didn't mention Lila. Why bring his wife into this unexpected moment with Valentina? He had tried to coax Lila into coming, but she had been feeling melancholy ever since her miscarriage after they returned from their honeymoon. Lila's doctor assured her she would be pregnant again, and Santiago told her there was no rush. She was 19. He was 23. They were young. They had time. Valentina wondered if friends included Lila. The idea of Santiago being married was, unexpectedly, still upsetting. Looking out the car window, as the massive concert-goers poured onto the sidewalks, she said,
"Weren't they incredible?"
"They were. Charlie Garcia's a genius," he said, referring to the rock group's composer, pianist, and singer.
Valentina had forgotten how impossibly handsome Santiago was. As he drove, she took in his profile, his pronounced jawline, his thick eyebrows, his narrow lips. She watched him effortlessly shift gears and maneuver the vehicle. These ordinary movements reflected an innate elegance she had loved.
"Where are you going?"
he asked her, taking his eyes off the road for a moment to look at her. His eyes were tender, and he was smiling again. At once, she was conscious of the fact that they were alone in a confined space and sat up stiffly.
"Home? I was ready to walk. Just drop me off wherever is convenient. There's so much traffic tonight."
"I'll drive you," he said,
and took a side street, hoping to find fewer cars.
"How have you been?"
"Good. Busy. I graduated a couple of months ago, and I'm now working for a professor,"
she answered, hoping her voice didn't betray the emotions that this chance encounter had awakened. The feelings were welling up inside of her, ready to spill over. Yet he seemed composed, acting as if he were driving an old friend.
"That's wonderful, Valentina."
"How about you?"
she managed to ask in a tone matching his.
"I have two more classes to go and I'll be finished. I know Maximo's almost done too. We occasionally bump into each other at school."
"Yes, he has some important exam tomorrow."
An uncomfortable silence filled the car at the mention of Maximo. To break it, Santiago switched on the radio. One of Sui Generis's songs came on. Listening, they couldn't hold back and began to sing along. When the song ended, they were at ease with one another again. The last time Valentina had been alone with Santiago had been the night he returned from Europe, not quite a year ago. She studied his strong hands firmly on the wheel. His long fingers with their perfectly trimmed nails would have been the envy of any pianist. She recalled how his fingers used to explore all of her with urgency. When Santiago saw how she was gazing at him, his heart swelled. He asked himself how he had survived all these months without her. After he had proposed to Lila, he had thrown himself fully into the relationship, getting swept up in the idea of marriage and his role as a husband and soon-to-be father. Lila was, as he had suspected, all that a husband could want in a wife, and in the weeks following their engagement, he had fallen in love with her. But seeing Valentina again, having her seated so close to him, suddenly made the last few months seem inconsequential. It was as if he had been playing at this other life all that time. No longer able to maintain his casual air, he blurted out, "I can't listen to one of their songs without thinking of us." "You should not be in his car," a voice within Valentina told her. She was silent for a moment. "I heard you got married." She stated it as a fact, not as a question, and not in an accusatory sort of way. After all, she had been the one to give him up, but she needed to say it out loud, to caution him. The two of them, that he was a married man, and she was in a serious relationship.
"I did, a couple of months ago. But I find that it doesn't keep me from thinking of us whenever one of their songs comes on."
She looked at him, not knowing how to answer. "I think of you too? What good would that do?" What they were both feeling, she should say to him, was a memory from the past. It would be the right thing to say. But it wasn't true. At least not for her. As she struggled to find an appropriate response, the car ahead slowed down. A roadblock had been set up, and the police, holding machine guns across their chests, directed traffic.
"I can hop out here," Valentina told him.
She wasn't ready to say goodbye to him. A part of her wanted to stay and savor this impossible encounter a little longer. But these police checkpoints, materializing everywhere, frightened her. She had witnessed people being patted down and then, without any visible reason, taken away. A police officer walked in front of them, making Santiago fully apply the brakes. The officer evaluated them through the windshield and signaled to his companion, who came up to the driver's side and commanded,
"Step out of the car, hands up in the air."
A wave of anxiety rushed through her. He whispered,
"Don't worry."
They got out as instructed.
"Face the car, hands on the roof."
Two officers held guns to the back of their heads, while the other two patted them down until they located their documents. A flashlight swept the inside of the car, the trunk. The squat man in charge told the others,
"We'll take the woman in for questioning."
Valentina stared, alarmed, at Santiago.
"But why? What's going on, officer?"
Santiago asked in a reasonable voice.
"We're looking for a dark-haired female student suspected of placing a bomb in a police captain's home," explained the younger-looking officer. "You'll see on my ID card that my name is Santiago Larrea. My father is Alfonso Larrea. General Delgado is an old family friend."
General Delgado was a rank below Jorge Rafael Videla, the new head of the armed forces. President Isabel Perón, under pressure from the military establishment, had appointed Videla, even though he was a staunch anti-Peronist. Videla's influence had grown, and he had begun to remove military officers and other government officials sympathetic to Perón. The purge included the Minister of Social Welfare, José López Rega, whom a newspaper link had exposed as the man behind the state-sponsored terrorist outfit, AAA. The police officers consulted quietly, examining again both documents.
"She's not your suspect. I can vouch for her. She's been with me all day,"
Santiago said evenly, unblinking in the flashlight directly on his face. Valentina's breathing had grown ragged, and her knuckles were white from gripping the car roof. After a few more tense moments, the officer in charge announced,
"You are free to go."
The younger one returned their ID cards. As soon as they were past the roadblock, Valentina let out a loud sob. Santiago remained calm and reached for her.
"It's over,"
he reassured her as he drove away as quickly as he could. They drove a few blocks in silence, reeling from the shock of the encounter. He pulled onto the dark street and parked in front of her building. Valentina had planned not to say anything about her change of address, but, rattled by the incident, she couldn't lie.
"I'm not at the dorm anymore."
He squinted at her and, with a shake of his head, said,
"Of course not. You're not a student anymore. So, where to?"
"You don't have to take me any farther. I can walk from here."
"I'm not going to let you walk alone, Valentina. Not at this hour. Not after what happened."
She considered his reasons, thinking there was no longer any point in hiding anything from him.
"I don't want you to drop me off. I'm leaving with Maximo."
"Ah."
Dabbing at her eyes with the sleeve of her jean jacket, she said,
"Thank you, Santiago. They would have taken me in if it hadn't been for you."
"But they didn't. You are here."
"You lied for me. You didn't have to. You could have gotten yourself in trouble."
"Valentina,"
he said, staring through the windshield at the empty street.
"Can't you tell? I would do anything for you."
He heard her softly call his name.
"Look at me."
He did. She was pulling out something from under her turtleneck. In wonder, he gazed at the pendant he had given her when their love was the only thing that mattered.
"You still wear it?"
he asked, puzzled but deeply pleased by the revelation. He held the blue lapis stone with its diamond chips, then flipped it and studied her carved initials. The night he gave it to her came rushing back. And now, she was so close to him, her scent was making his heart gallop. He looked up from the stone. Her eyes, brimming with tears, met his. She closed her eyes as he pressed his cheek against hers, waiting for a sign from her. She turned her face slightly so that his mouth was on her cheek. He began kissing her face until his lips found her mouth. Chapter 27, August 1998. The day after talking to Soledad Goldberg, I met Juan for a coffee, and, to my relief, he amicably agreed that our fling had run its course. Walking back to the apartment, I felt my mood lift. Rays of sunlight breached the low-hanging morning clouds. It felt as if the sun had melted away my uncertainties, making way for a clearer sense of myself. As I turned the corner onto my block, I slowed and retrieved my phone to check my messages. My father had left a voicemail, wondering if I was coming back to the ranch that day. I wasn't ready to see my parents, and decided to tell them that Juan had invited me out. I was starting to tap the number for El Pinar into my phone when my right shoulder grazed against a man who was studying our building directory. Mumbling an apology, I began to pass, but the man moved, standing in my way. When I attempted to go around him again, he shifted, blocking my path.
"Excuse me, señorita. Do you know which apartment number belongs to Mr. Santiago Larrea? I'm an old friend, and I heard he's in town. I tried getting in touch with him, but we keep missing each other. He left me a message to come visit, but, stupid me, I can't remember the apartment number."
"He's not here," I answered.
"Ah, you know him."
"I'm his daughter."
"You're Paloma?"
"Yes."
"How lucky of me to run into his daughter,"
he smiled.
"My, you've grown into a beautiful young woman. Santiago and Lila must be proud."
His eyes on me were making me uncomfortable. And then I realized I had seen him before. At the press conference, he had been the one who asked my father about our family. He had heard my father was in town? He was an old friend? Clearly,
he was lying. How had he gotten this address? It dawned on me that he might be the person who wrote the unsigned note I found in Dad's wallet, demanding a meeting. I signaled to the doorman through the glass.
Well, as I said, he's not here, I replied coolly.
Would you give him a message, then? Please tell him Pedro Garcia offers his warmest congratulations on his political appointment.
Sure. The doorman let me inside. Waiting for the elevator, I glanced back. The man hadn't left. He was staring at me, a disquieting smile on his face. He bowed his head before walking away. After taking a hot shower, I called the ranch to tell my parents that I was having a lot of fun in Buenos Aires and planned to stay a few more days. They were out, but I spoke to Abuelo, who was disappointed. I promised that when I returned, I would devote myself entirely to him for the remainder of my trip. Back on the street, I walked quickly. After we left Guerin the night before, Franco mentioned again that he knew someone we could talk to about clandestine births. I rationalized that, at this point, we should follow Valentina Quintero's story wherever it might lead, and, if possible, find out what happened to her baby. Linking this woman's story to my own birth was a crazy theory, but I decided it was best to put any speculation to rest. I agreed to meet him the next day at Plaza de Mayo, where a protest was going to take place. His contact would be there. When I rounded the corner onto Avenida de Mayo and saw the square, I came to a full stop. Was it possible that my parents and I had driven through Plaza de Mayo not even a week ago? The square was as crowded as on the day we arrived. It was another protest against Coronel Aldo Rico's appointment as head of the federal police force. As people of all ages marched by, my heart sped up. How had I ended up in such a mess? This was not my world. I should turn around and leave, I thought. Put what had become a sinister investigation behind me and return to New York. Emily had emailed me that two jewelry stores on the Lower East Side had expressed interest in carrying some of my pieces. I missed Emily, my friends, my old life. I was resolving to leave when a hand grabbed my elbow.
I was beginning to think you had changed your mind about coming here.
It was Franco. His fingers were firm around my arm. Had he sensed that I was thinking of leaving? He kissed my cheek.
But I'm here now, I said, understanding at that moment that there would be no turning back. Police officers stood around the periphery of the march. Some tapped their clubs against their hand. Franco didn't let go of my arm, but I found his grip strangely reassuring, the gentle squeeze of his strong hand suppressing my mounting anxiety. I was not alone. We were in this together. A group of old women walked in unison. Franco hollered to one of them,
Viviana!
A woman of petite stature looked over, and a smile formed on her aged face. She kissed his cheek.
Franco, my dear boy, how long has it been? How are you? And your sister and brother? Everyone doing well?
The old woman affectionately rattled off her questions. Franco smiled, saying,
Everyone's good.
The woman's navy wool coat fell to just below her knees, and she wore thick beige stockings and sensible black shoes. Wiry gray hairs escaped from under her white headscarf with embroidered writing that read,
Robertino Esposito. Desaparecido, 23rd February, 1977. Stella Maris Esposito, desaparecida, 23rd February, 1977. 5 months pregnant.
Franco explained that Viviana Esposito was a member of the Abuelas de Plaza de Mayo, dedicating her life to finding the remains of her missing son, daughter-in-law, and unborn grandchild.
Viviana, I want to introduce you to my friend, Paloma.
Hello, I said, bending down to kiss her cheek.
We fell into step with Viviana and the other madres, proceeding behind a large banner with the words, Nunca más, never again, stretching across the length of a row of 12 mothers and grandmothers walking with locked arms.
We need to talk to you,
Franco told Viviana after circling the square a few times. We found an empty bench, and Viviana rested her protest sign next to her. Removing one of her gloves, she rubbed her right knee, quite swollen compared to the other one.
Arthritis, she explained, and then turned to Franco. Talk to me. How can I help?
We need to ID someone who thinks she may be the daughter of a desaparecida.
Nodding, she said,
The most effective method is a new type of test where they sample your DNA.
But don't you need the mother's body? I asked.
A member of the immediate family will do. And all that's needed is a blood or a hair sample, thank God. If not, we would never get anywhere. Any living relatives?
No. The desaparecida's parents are dead. No siblings either,
Franco told her.
So what do you have?
The mother was held at ESMA. Baby was born in captivity, possibly in September of 76.
That's specific enough. If she didn't give birth in her cell, then there's a good chance she may have had the baby at San Rafael Hospital. The military destroyed most of the documents, but your friend could still go and inquire. She might be able to get some information.
Thanks, Viviana. This is helpful.
Viviana placed her hands on the bench to hoist herself up. While rearranging her headscarf, she explained,
Many babies stolen during the dictatorship grow up with a sense that something's not right. Sometimes that discord is felt within the dynamics of their family, but almost always within themselves. As they get older, the feeling of displacement becomes obvious and, sooner or later, has to be acknowledged.
Her eyes found mine.
It's important to pay attention to that instinct.
Unable to hold the old woman's gaze, I looked away. Franco handed Viviana her sign. They kissed goodbye. She started back, but then turned and said,
Come by the office anytime you want. We are ready to help.
We wandered away from the square and the crowds into the downtown district, which, on that Sunday, was deserted in comparison. After a few blocks, we turned right and crossed the wide avenue separating downtown from the waterfront. We passed through the trendy Puerto Madero district, whose old port buildings had been repurposed into luxury condos and upscale cafes and restaurants. From there, we headed farther toward the river, past the Costanera Sur Park, to a network of walking paths near the Rio de la Plata. We walked by a man who was reeling in a fishing rod, and Franco paused to ask, Catch anything? The man held up his wrist. From it dangled an antique-looking watch on a rusty metal strap.
Just this old thing. Doesn't even work.
A family was picnicking beneath some nearby trees. The children gathered their toys while the mother wrapped up the leftover food, and the father doused the coals still smoldering in the grill. Franco asked if I was hungry. This time, I said yes. We stopped at a street vendor's food stand, and Franco ordered two choripanes. The vendor opened two buns and stuffed them with the chorizo sausages, which he then sliced in half. He spooned a generous helping of chimichurri onto the butterflied sausages and swiftly wrapped each choripan in a wax napkin. As soon as we were seated on a bench, I took a hearty bite of the sandwich, and the green sauce splattered on my jeans. Franco shook his head.
Rookie move.
He stood, facing me.
You have to hold it out in front of you. See?
His body leaned forward, legs spread apart, so that when he took a bite, the juice spilled onto the boardwalk and not on his clothes.
Ta-da!
He exclaimed like a magician might. You're quite the pro, I smiled, clapping one hand on my thigh. He sat back down beside me. Did you know that chimichurri has become a trendy sauce in New York? Chefs are serving it on all sorts of grilled meat these days.
What?
Franco pretended to choke on his bread.
Sacrilege! Don't your fellow Americans know that it only ever goes on a chorizo? A steak, perfectly prepared, does not need any sort of condiment.
With a somber look and one hand on my shoulder, he said,
You have your work cut out for you when you return to New York.
You're right, Mr. Bonetti. And I promise to do my best.
I replied in a serious voice and burst out laughing.
Chimichurri is no laughing matter,
he lectured me as his face lightened into a playful smile. As the sun fell below the horizon, the waterways of the riverfront district went from a murky brown to an impenetrable black. When the temperature dropped, Franco offered me his coat and suggested we head back. I would have been content to remain seated on the bench beside him for the rest of the night, but I agreed. When we arrived at my building, we made a plan to meet up again in the morning to go to San Rafael Hospital. He gave me a peck on the cheek and turned to leave.
Franco, wait.
I moved toward him until I was close enough to see that his glasses were a little smudged. He must have noticed, because he removed them, brought them up to his mouth, and breathed hard, once on each lens, before wiping them clean with a handkerchief. When he put them back on, he regarded me thoughtfully.
Are you sure?
I nodded and closed my eyes in expectation.
What about your friend?
I opened my eyes.
What friend?
Juan was the last thing on my mind. Franco smiled his beautiful smile. He cupped my face in his hands. Our lips almost touched, and he hesitated before he kissed me once, and then twice, and then again. Chapter 28, November 1975. Surprisingly nimble for his height, Santiago scrambled up a bare Palo Rosa tree to the second floor of the building. He took in the view of the darkened and quiet street and then searched for a bare branch to wrap on the window. Hunched over her drawing table, Valentina jumped at the sound. When she saw Santiago's face against the glass, she let out a gasp. She raised the window and cried out,
Are you crazy?
He pulled himself through and, like a cat, dropped down onto the floor on all fours.
I'm sorry, mi amor.
Santiago had been so excited to see her, he hadn't considered how she might react. He continued toward her, but she stepped back.
What are you doing here? We are not supposed to see each other tonight. I have a deadline tomorrow.
I was in the neighborhood.
As he spoke, he took a few more steps toward her until she ended up against the wall. His arms stretched out on either side of her with no way out. Smiling victoriously, he leaned in to kiss her.
I thought you'd appreciate my Romeo-esque entrance.
Hard to appreciate it when you've just scared the hell out of me.
I didn't mean to. I'm sorry, my love. But you want to know why I did it? Your superintendent. He's starting to be suspicious of me. All these repeat visits from one of your clients? He's not buying it. You should have seen the look he gave me when I left the other day.
Jose?
Valentina wrinkled her nose.
Don't worry about him. I'll tell him you're one of those typical pain-in-the-ass clients who constantly changes his mind about the layout of his house.
Santiago kissed her again, and this time she responded.
Has he been here yet?
The question slipped out before he could catch himself. They usually tiptoed around any mention of their partners.
I mean your super, Jose. Has he been inside?
Why do you ask, Santiago?
She gazed at him.
Jealous?
No. No. That's not why.
Loosening his hold on her, he grew serious.
You should be careful with who you let in.
He looked around the mostly empty space.
Sooner or later, you're going to have to get proper furniture.
buy whatever it is that an architect needs to get her work done, he said, changing the subject.
Her eyes followed his arms, gesturing around the room. I know, but I need to save up.
Valentina had yet to start making any real money. A former professor had recently hired her to draw perspectives for a residence in the affluent neighborhood of San Isidro. She was feeling optimistic that this job would lead to other opportunities.
I told you I'd help you.
If I let you start to pay for my things, I'll feel like your mistress, she said, and smiled up at him, no longer mad.
But I want to take care of you. Please, let me.
The first time he showed up at her studio, not counting the night of the concert 2 months ago now, he had come bearing gifts, useful ones he knew she would not be able to turn down. They were professionally wrapped in brown construction paper, and as she opened them, her eyes widened with delight at each new tool: a parallel straight-edge bar, vellum and tracing paper, an architectural scale, triangles, a lead holder and lead pointer, an eraser shield. Santiago hadn't known if there would be a second time when she brought him to her studio after the concert. But after they made love, they couldn't let go of each other. They understood their love had never truly gone away. Raking her fingers through his hair, she murmured,
I don't need you to take care of me. What I need you to do is make love to me, right now.
Drawing his face to hers, she brought him down to the floor with her. His efforts to undress her were useless. Valentina was in command. When she finished removing his clothes, she pulled up her wool skirt and straddled him. Lying beneath her as she rocked back and forth, his body told her,
I am yours, I am yours, until she moaned in his ear and he rushed himself into her.
Later, stretched out face to face on his overcoat, he shook his head in wonder.
What?
She asked.
I was just thinking that it's been forever since I climbed a tree.
You could have gotten yourself killed, and for no good reason,
she softly scolded him.
To visit the girl of my dreams? That's a pretty good reason, I'd say.
He reached for her, and giggling, she rolled over a lump in his coat. From underneath her back, she pulled out a rolled-up newspaper inside his coat pocket. It was the evening edition.
Bad boy! She hit him with the paper. You broke one of our rules, remember?
The paper struck his arms a few more times.
No news from the outside world.
You're right. Sorry.
Santiago held up his hands in surrender, trying not to grin.
I wasn't sure I would find you still here, and I hadn't read the paper yet.
When he reached to take it back, she turned away from him and unfurled it. She was quiet as she read.
What is it?
Nothing, she said.
But she was biting her lower lip and wouldn't take her eyes off the front page. He sat up on one elbow and, over her shoulder, glimpsed the headline in bold print. Urban gorillas die in standoff in city center. 4 urban leftist gorillas, believed to be members of the People's Revolutionary Army, ERP, were shot dead after a failed attempt to bomb a restaurant frequented by off-duty police officers. The ambush took place at... The week before, another newspaper had reported a suspicious fire in the neighborhood of Flores, where 3 bodies had been found in a pile of refuse in an abandoned lot. The authorities had identified the victims as subversives involved in a counteroffensive. But there were rumors these standoffs were staged by the AAA. Another rumor was that political dissidents held in clandestine jails would be released in the middle of the night. Told to run, they were then shot and killed, and later reported as subversives who had escaped from jail. The news upset Valentina. Maximo's unexplained absences upset her. The Friday after she ran into Santiago at the concert, Maximo had disappeared for 3 days without an explanation or phone call. Too worried to work or sleep, thinking he had been killed, she had almost killed him herself when, on the 4th day, he finally walked through the front door. The rush of relief at the sight of him quickly turned to anger.
His militancy had become more important than their relationship. She resented him putting his life in danger. He tried to justify himself, but she didn't give him a chance. The uneasiness she felt cheating on him was mixed in with her reaction. Unbeknownst to Maximo, his absence had given her the extra push she needed to break it off. Moving into the studio would bring her peace, she thought, but she remained divided by her feelings for both men. The separation lasted 10 days. Maximo pleaded with her. His activism was losing meaning, he told her. He was fighting for a better world, but his life was nothing without her. If she didn't come back to their home, he wouldn't care what became of him. Valentina listened while she studied him. He looked like he was coming apart, like he might be losing his mind. Her resolve weakened. She moved back in with him, but soon he returned to his secret activities. He was needed, he said, apologizing. The cause couldn't wait, and she understood. She did. The repression, the violence, was affecting them all. It had to stop, and Maximo was sure the work he and others were doing would bring about the necessary change. Now Valentina folded the newspaper and gave it back to Santiago. Take it. Put it away, she said flatly. They dressed in silence. Santiago bent down to retrieve his shirt and sweater. Santi? Santiago's mind was elsewhere. On Lila. Before leaving that morning, she believed he was spending the day in class or at the library. Lila had made him promise that he wouldn't be late to dinner again. Her parents were coming. He was to pick up some bread rolls on the way home. She had wanted something else. What was it? Wine? He would buy a bottle or two at the wine store around the corner from their apartment. Santiago? Valentina's voice brought him back. Sorry. What were you saying? I was asking if you would ever leave the city and settle in the campo? Conversations that involved future hypotheticals were another no-no in Valentina's rulebook. He glanced at her before pulling the sweater over his head. Would you? She asked again, rising to her feet. It had been a long time since he had entertained such a notion. What would his life look like if he moved out to El Pinar for good? It would mean working full-time with his father and leaving behind the opportunity to work at a law firm after he graduated at the end of the year. Adjusting his shirt collar, he casually said, "Haven't really thought about it." What if I were to tell you that I'm thinking about leaving, going back to my parents' home in Córdoba? But you just rented this place. He picked up his coat from the floor. I know. And this might sound silly, but I miss my mother's garden. Lately, I've been daydreaming a lot about lying in my old hammock among her flowers. He frowned, unsure how to respond. Was she testing him? What about Maximo? From Valentina's few vague remarks since their affair began, Santiago had drawn, in his mind, an outline of his friend's present life. He gathered that Maximo was not going to follow the traditional route of joining a law practice. Instead, he had been using his degree to do pro bono work for residents at shantytowns in and outside the city. He was also planning to defend political prisoners. However, for the moment, Maximo's only source of income seemed to come from freelance gigs as a comic book illustrator. Would you? She found his hand and pressed it to her cheek. Leave the city? Kissing his palm, she asked. Come with me? During these past few weeks of furtively seeing each other, Santiago had not dared to think of such a possibility and had grown used to the unconventional rhythms of his life. Valentina had begged him a few times to end the affair, saying she was too weak to do it. What they were doing was wrong, she would say. But he wouldn't. He didn't want to. He was only truly alive when he was with her. Santiago hated deceiving Lila, but he didn't have a choice, not for the moment. It would be insensitive, cruel even, to leave Lila so soon after marrying her and losing the baby. More time needed to pass. Since Valentina had re-entered his life, he had felt himself involuntarily stiffen around Leela, although he thought he didn't show it. But he must have been acting differently, because at times she was clingy, as if she sensed he was reserving a part of himself. Guilt engulfed him whenever he remembered everything he had come to love about Leela. How she had been by his side when his father had suffered his heart attack. How easily she had bonded with his mother, fit in with his family. How she went along with whatever Santiago wanted. She was lovely, beautiful, and his heart had broken for the two of them when she miscarried their child. But at the bottom of his soul, he knew he would never stop loving Valentina. He could only ever be half the man Leela deserved. Santiago rolled the newspaper and tucked it into his coat pocket. When he looked at Valentina again, it was with searching eyes.
"Are you being serious?"
he finally asked.
"I've never been more serious in my life."
Chapter 29. August, 1998. San Rafael Hospital was located in the north section of Buenos Aires, in a sprawling neighborhood called Palermo. We arrived early, hoping to beat the crowd, but the waiting area was already full. After standing for a while, Franco said he'd be back in a moment. When two plastic chairs became available, I sat down in one and put my purse on the other one to save it for Franco. The walls were a ghastly green, and the fluorescent lights emitted a low hum, flickering intermittently. No one else seemed bothered by either the drab surroundings or the interminable waiting. It was as if they had all been forewarned that any inquiry in the administrative offices would be an all-day affair. My mind returned to the night before. After kissing outside my building, I invited Franco up to my grandfather's apartment. Franco dropped onto my favorite sofa, pulling me down with him, so that I ended up sitting on his lap. My arms went around his slim neck. His lips were warm and plump, and his mouth tasted slightly of Coca-Cola. But, after a moment, his lips grew rigid. When I opened my eyes, I saw he was looking elsewhere.
"What's wrong?"
I asked, convinced it had to do with me.
"Nothing." Franco gently moved me off his lap. "Would you mind, telling me, is there a service entrance?"
I wanted to laugh. At least it wasn't about me. But his curiosity about another possible door was affecting him. He clenched his jaw and anxiously fidgeted with his fingers. I pointed to the right, explaining that the back door was through the kitchen, next to the maid's quarters. Franco got up. I remained in the living room. I fixed my shirt and gathered my tangled hair into a ponytail. When Franco came back, he said it was late. He needed to go home. It was an awkward goodbye, even as we finalized plans to meet up again the next day. Today. Emily probably would have advised me not to see Franco again. But there I was, seated in an uncomfortable chair in a cold and unpleasant room, waiting for him. He returned with two coffees, in small brown plastic cups. He added a packet of sugar to each, stirring them with a flimsy plastic stick, then handed one to me. The coffee had a filmy layer on top. It tasted watery and too sugary, but I sipped it until it was gone.
"Number 45? Number 45, please come forward."
A woman with frosted auburn hair pulled back into a knot with a large hair clip sat behind the glass partition. The name tag pinned to her white lab coat read, "Carla Rivas." She took our ticket and, with a glance, confirmed the number.
"Good morning,"
she greeted us through the glass opening.
"Good morning to you,"
Franco began with a friendly smile. Our request was pretty straightforward, he told her. We needed access to the hospital birth records for 1976.
"You have to be a direct relative of the baby in question, and we need to see two pieces of identification before we can commence the process,"
she responded.
He leaned forward. "But I'm sure you can find a way to make an exception for us, Carla. Yes?"
"I'm sorry, but there's nothing I can do."
"We should go,"
I suggested.
Carla, come on. Help me out here,
he pressed on, with what he and I both hoped was a winning smile.
Bring the proper documents next time,
she said with more authority.
All right, then. Thanks for your time,
he replied courteously. But before moving off to the side, his fist came down firmly on the counter. We walked through the hospital courtyard, Franco's hands shoved deep in his pockets.
We tried, Franco. It's okay.
Besides, I paused, knowing he wouldn't like what I was about to say.
I'm not sure I want to continue with this.
When Franco had offered to help me, I was certain I would stop at nothing to find out more about my father's role in the resistance against the dictatorship and the disappearance of Valentina Quintero. But I never imagined it would lead to questions about what happened to her baby and about my own birth. My mind was having a hard time keeping up, and I wanted to slow the investigation down. He looked askance at me and reached inside his coat pocket for his cigarettes.
Okay, fine. Let's go,
he said. A woman in a white lab coat walked up to us.
Here.
She extended her lit cigarette. He brought his cigarette to hers and puffed until the tip glowed red.
Thanks.
He read her name tag.
Bettina Paulsen.
I work in the front office,
Bettina said, waving back to some co-workers across the hospital courtyard. In a hushed voice, she said to Franco,
I overheard your request in the office. What exactly are you looking for?
Franco glanced at her and nodded warily before answering,
We need to confirm the identity of a baby's parents. And the only way to do that is by locating the original birth record.
He paused. Clearly, experience had taught him to be cautious about trusting people in his country. But sometimes there was no choice.
We are pretty certain the baby was born at this hospital during the dictatorship in 1976.
Bettina waited until a hospital worker walked by. She then leaned toward his ear, muttering something I could not make out. I could, however, tell from Franco's face that our visit to the hospital might not have been in vain. Chapter 30, December, 1975. While the sun slowly dropped behind the low-rise buildings, leaving hues of pink and purple in the sky, Santiago watched commuters scurrying toward the train terminal.
Is she going to come this time?
He was waiting on one of the benches in a plaza in the Constitución neighborhood. Valentina had asked to see him someplace where the chances of running into someone they knew were slim. And not at her studio. She had been firm on that point. The first time she had asked to meet him in a public place, she hadn't shown up. When they spoke again by phone, she barely apologized, only saying she hadn't been able to get away. He hadn't seen her since she had proposed that he leave the city with her almost 3 weeks ago. Why was she avoiding him? Did Maximo suspect something? People sat on nearby benches, enjoying an unusually cool late spring evening. Santiago zipped his jacket as he glanced again at the street, hoping to spot her. Two policemen were headed toward him, but then they changed direction, approaching a group of students instead.
IDs, please.
The students nervously reached into their back pockets and purses. One long-haired young man took out his identification card from his wallet, but when he went to hand it to the officer, it slipped out of his hand onto the ground. The police officer's boot covered the card, nearly stepping on the student's hand as he bent down to pick it up. A young woman politely asked the officer to remove his boot so her boyfriend could retrieve his ID card.
Of course, miss.
The officer spoke those words while undressing her with his eyes. She, in turn, gave him a look of loathing. He lifted his boot, uncovering the now soiled card. The boyfriend quickly picked it up, wiped it on his jeans, and handed it over. The other officer studied the identification cards, matching the photos to the students. Everyone appeared to be in the clear, and the students became less tense.
You.
The officer pointed to the long-haired man.
You're coming with us.
The girlfriend turned to the officer. He gave her a malicious smile. She tugged at her boyfriend's arm, a silent plea for him not to go.
The rest of you, get moving.
As the students gathered their things, Santiago heard one of them complain to the others.
But they can't take him just like that.
Shh, stop talking or we'll be next.
One of the women put her arms around the girlfriend, whose earlier show of bravado had dissolved into despair. The students hurried through the plaza, passing Valentina on their way out. The sight of her made Santiago's pulse race with excitement. He took her behind one of the tall palm trees. He went to kiss her, but she only gave him her cheek.
I've called you at your studio a few times.
He wanted to sound casual, but it came out more like a whine.
I'm sorry.
Are you okay? I've been worried.
I'm fine.
I've missed you. We need to discuss our plan. Córdoba.
The tree trunk didn't hide them from the public eye, but he didn't care. He held out his hand. She wouldn't take it.
Santiago,
Valentina's expression told him what was coming next, but he was prepared.
Everything's going to be great for us. I needed some time, but I've worked it all out,
he said with more confidence in his voice than he actually felt.
Please, don't make this any harder. We both know we shouldn't have. It was wrong. Even if they never find out, and I hope they don't, we hurt them both.
He wasn't listening.
I'm leaving, Lila. It's decided. I couldn't break it off with her sooner, but now I can. Lila and Maximo will understand that we haven't stopped loving each other. Lila is young. We don't have children, and I'm confident she'll find someone new soon. Someone who'll really make her happy. You and I can finally start our life together.
I've been thinking a lot, and it's too late, Santiago,
Valentina replied with a weary tone.
It's not too late, and I don't love Lila. Not like I love you.
Santiago took her hands.
I have a present for you. For us. I was going to surprise you. I bought a small plot of land.
He pinned her to the tree trunk.
Near where you took me swimming that day we drove to the music festival in Cosquín. It's not too far from your parents, he added with a smile.
Christmas was 3 weeks away, and he pictured them spending it in Córdoba with her family. They would drive to the property by the river, and Valentina would begin to envision the type of home she might design for the two of them. It could be a simple cabin. He didn't have an opinion, as long as they were together.
You did?
Yes.
His forehead touched hers.
You can have your own garden. I didn't get you a hammock, not yet. I thought we could pick out two hammocks together. One for you, one for me. I'm also thinking of looking into the vet school in Córdoba City.
Santiago, I don't know what to say.
Say yes.
I can't. I can't leave Maximo. I tried once already. It won't work. He needs me. He's been contributing illustrations to this underground paper, and he's involved in other things he doesn't talk to me about. He's told me I'm the only reason he comes home at night. I wouldn't forgive myself if something happened to him because I wasn't there.
Valentina had been looking down, but now she raised her face, imploring him with her eyes to let her go one more time. She thought back to the day she asked herself if she could love two men at the same time. The answer remained the same. She loved them both.
We're too different, you and I. It would never work in the end. Lila's good for you. You shouldn't leave her.
Stop.
He put two fingers on her lips.
Stop thinking with your head.
Santiago then put his hand on her chest.
Listen, do you hear? I'm talking to your heart now.
He searched for her mouth, but she turned her cheek. His lips landed on her jaw. His head motioned toward the train station.
We can leave on the next train.
I can't.
Valentina slowly disengaged from his embrace.
This is goodbye, Santiago.
He swallowed hard.
You need time. I can see that. And that's fine. I'll wait for you.
Please, don't,
she said. In her smile, he saw sadness, regret. She gave him the briefest of kisses and turned, leaving as quickly as she arrived. Chapter 31, August 1998. After we left San Rafael Hospital and walked a block or two, Franco said,
Tomorrow morning I'm going to follow up on something Bettina said. She asked me to meet her alone, if that's okay with you.
I said it was fine. Then he checked his watch and smiled, his mood improved by this new lead. He asked,
I have a class later, but do you want to come over for a coffee?
He lived in a different section of Palermo, referred to as Palermo Viejo. It was a neighborhood of tree-lined cobblestone streets, outdoor cafes, and Spanish-style homes, some with beautifully carved oak doors dating back to the 19th century. Upon entering his apartment, I noticed there wasn't much furniture. Rows of books and VHS tapes filled the shelves of one wall, and I walked over for a closer inspection. Evidently, one or both Bonetti brothers were cinephiles. Framed posters of Fellini's La Dolce Vita and Truffaut's The 400 Blows hung on either side of the television set. The small kitchen had an island with bar stools dividing it from the living area. Doors on opposite ends of the living room led to the bedrooms and a bathroom. Bare treetops reached the wide living room windows, which were slightly open and let in a cool breeze. No male college friend of mine had an apartment that didn't look like it had been hit by a tornado. Even if Franco's place was not totally neat, everything was in its place. It felt like it had been put together with loving care. I sat on the sofa and watched Franco raise and lower the living room window a couple of times. He leaned his head out, looking down two flights to the street. He then backed away from the window and walked past me toward the kitchen. Curious, I tracked him with my eyes. He went to a small alcove, opened the service door, and stepped out. I heard him move something heavy. When he was done, he returned to the kitchen and began whistling softly while pouring us both glasses of sparkling water. He sat beside me, and after we drank from our glasses, he took my hand in his. A young man padded barefoot into the living room, rubbing his eyes.
Hey,
he said, looking as if he had slept in his clothes.
What's up?
Franco left my side. The men hugged.
Paloma, this is my younger brother. Luis, meet Paloma.
Luis reacted like he hadn't heard my name before. We exchanged greetings and he sat down across from us.
Coffee?
Franco asked, and went to one of the cabinets to get some cups.
Are you also studying?
I asked Luis, after we sat in silence for a few moments, while Franco prepared the coffee. He nodded.
Film.
Like your father,
I remarked.